tonight I want to talk about something that we tend to forget in all of the talk about suffering that goes on in Buddhism, that it's not about suffering. It's dealing with suffering. But it's really about the opposite. It's about being free from suffering, which is a state that's almost unimaginable for most of us. We think that, well, the opposite of suffering would be happiness, but don't sell the farm for that. You know, that you would really be shortchanging yourself. The opposite is actually beyond joy. And that's the topic of tonight's talk. Because that state is so hard to put into words, I've employed a couple of helpers. One is a book called Buddha's Brain by my friend Rick Hansen and Rick Mendius. I know Rick Hansen. We went through the Community Dharma Leader program together. He's a PhD neuropsychologist who's been studying neuroscience for many, many years. And the other resource is this wonderful collection of poems called Dancing with Joy, edited by Roger Housden. And I think the poetry goes to places where logic cannot. And so I'm using it tonight to put the dot on the point. Buddha's insight was that we have a built-in problem. All beings want to be happy. But for human beings, that's difficult, just in our very nature. Animal nervous systems are rigged to let the creatures know when a survival strategy isn't working. And this is by a pain response, which kind of signals to the animal then and in the future, don't do that. So the higher animals, which we pride ourselves on being, have responses that are painful and sometimes agonizing. We call them emotions. And some examples are rage or grief or terror. These are the body's way to try to keep us alive. Because our bodies inhabit a world of prey and predator. It's just the way planet Earth is. And our brains have been both prey and predator. The results illustrates three of the ideas that Buddha came up with. The characteristics of all experience. They are in Pali, anatta, anicca, and dukkha, or no self, change, and suffering. Now, anatta comes into play, or anatta comes into play, because we see this as a world of us versus them, or me against it, self versus other. And Buddha's insight was that this is a false perception. As human beings, our main survival strategy is learning. And as a survival strategy, that depends on stability, so that we can apply what we've learned to the next situation. But as Buddha pointed out, everything is always changing, anicca. There is no permanence. So this great survival strategy of ours has some built-in dukkha. And that's the third characteristic of all experience, that our brains prompt us to pursue pleasure and to flee pain. But because of these other two situations, mostly because of change, these lessons we learned about what leads to pleasure and pain don't always work. Now you'd think, given how intelligent human beings are, that these automatic responses would become obsolete through our intelligence. But our intelligence actually magnifies our suffering. Because unlike other animals, which I guess we have to kind of assume are operating in one dimension of time, which is now, we get to suffer in three dimensions of time. Because we can imagine pain in the past and in the future, as well as what we're experiencing right now, and we do it all the time. Rick Hansen says that without all of the technological breakthroughs that have enabled neuroscience to look under the hood of our minds, Buddha was able to understand perfectly well how the engine works. And he offered a solution to our problem as thinking animals. And that solution is the Eightfold Path. It's divided into three aspects. The first is ethics. That's a pretty straightforward formula. Live by a code that cools the fires of greed and hatred. Take our energy away from the causes of the suffering. And another aspect of the Eightfold Path is practice or bhavana, mind training. And Buddha's suggestion is to cultivate the capacity to see through our physiologically based responses. In other words, when we sit in meditation, we develop some concentration and some mindfulness, and we can observe the thoughts that lead to suffering. And we can feel the emotions resonate in our bodies and tell us, this is suffering. And then there's a third aspect of practice, which I'll talk about a little more. And that enables us to root out these mental causes of suffering. And as the third aspect of the Eightfold Path, wisdom develops insights that lead to a more accurate worldview. We are not separate selves. It isn't me against the world, or self and other. But we're all part of one vast, unified process. And if you don't believe me, maybe William Wordsworth will have a little more authority. Compared to the Buddha, he's pretty recent a writer, but it's been several generations. This is part of his very famous poem, Tintern Abbey. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with joy of elevated thoughts. A sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is in the light of the setting suns, and the round ocean, and the living air, and the blue sky, and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. So to recap, sum it up so far, the brain's job is to keep us alive, not to make us happy. It doesn't care. To do its job, it remembers danger. The injury that we've sustained and our physiological responses. It remembers it. It holds on to it. It doesn't let go of the hard things. Thus, we naturally tend toward the negative. Building up a background tone in our minds that's painful. Because our brains are focused on holding on to these negative experiences to keep us from having them again, it devotes very little neural space to positive experiences. So the brain is, it's kind of contrary to the way we think, but the brain isn't doing anything toward keeping us happy. That's totally our job. And Holly Moore has a poem called Mind Wanting More. Only a beige slat of sun above the horizon, like a shade pulled not quite down. Otherwise clouds, sea rippled here and there, birds reluctant to fly. The mind wants a shaft of sun to stir the gray porridge of clouds, an osprey to stitch the sea and sky with its barred wings, some dramatic music, a symphony, perhaps a Chinese gong. But the mind always wants more than it has. One more bright day of sun, one more clear night in bed with the moon, one more hour to get the words right, one more chance for the heart in hiding to emerge from its thicket in dried grasses. As if this quiet day with its tentative light weren't enough, as if joy weren't strewn all around. So Buddha's remedy to our problem as thinking beings is wise effort. I mentioned before, part of the aspect of bhavana, or practice. And it is to literally accentuate the positive and not give so much energy to the negative. The brain is already doing that. We need to counterbalance it. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, water the flowers, not the weeds. Buddha said to observe the causes of suffering. And as we do this practice, we see that the causes of our suffering are not external things or people or events, but what we think of as internal, our own thoughts, emotions, assumptions, and attitudes. Rick Hansen's and other meditation teachers' prescription is to guide the attention toward the positive and away from the negative. And by this, I do not mean the normal pleasure-seeking tendency of the brain. This is just to savor our own positive responses and not seeking the causes of those responses. In other words, when you have a cup of tea, enjoy the warmth of the cup. Hold the attention on the body's response of delight. The brain isn't going to do that for us. Give it a few extra moments of input to really have an impact on the brain. Hey, here's pleasure. When you're walking down the street and you smell jasmine, breathe mindfully and savor the sweetness, recognizing your connectedness with all of life. When you achieve a goal, love the talents that let you do that. Celebrate the good consequence and enjoy the feelings that arise. Don't dwell on what a great person you are and how next time you're going to conquer the whole world. Just enjoy what is. Recognize the difference between enjoying what's true in the moment and craving something that may be in the future or the past. And now the ever wise and popular Mary Oliver has some words about being mindful. That's the title of the poem, Mindful. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. Grass. Have you ever seen the grass on a field ripple with the wind? It looks like a vast crowd of people who are bowing in prayer. Or one can imagine it that way. Rick says that this attention, this careful, intentional attention to the positive in our immediate experience restructures the brain to take in even more positive experience. It forms memories that make our mental environment more positive, and we just naturally become progressively more happy. In other words, we're training the brain to be receptive to joy, not acquisitive of what we think leads to joy. I'm sorry if I just keep hammering on that, but it's a very important difference. Now, with regard to suffering, and as a Buddhist, of course, I'm obliged to talk about that at least once, we train our brain to be equanimous rather than aversive. So that when something happens that is painful, that we don't like, we just accept the experience. It's happened. And we don't get caught up in the kind of thinking that will just drag it out and magnify our suffering. And the kind of thinking I'm talking about here is the, oh, why me? Why did this happen now? Everything goes wrong for me. I just may as well, yada da yada da yada. And it just takes something bad and makes it horrible. So as the brain is conditioned, reconditioned, and we continue on this path of practice and Buddhist strategy, we're moving away from a happiness that's conditional on external causes and conditions. We're moving toward something that Buddha calls the deathless, the unconditioned. Happiness becomes self-generating and sustaining. Now I'd like to read a poem by William Stafford called Why I Am Happy. Now has come an easy time. I let it roll. There is a lake somewhere, so blue and far, nobody owns it. A wind comes by and a willow listens gracefully. I hear all this every summer. I laugh and cry for every turn of the world, its terribly cold, innocent spin. That lake stays blue and free. It goes on, and I know where it is. In this state of mind, this unconditioned happiness, unconditional happiness that is beyond joy, the slings and arrows of life, of fortune, continue. It's inevitable. Things will go one way and then another. But still, all experience is suffused with a love and a delight that does not depend on conditions. So I'd like, in closing, to read you not a challenge, but encouragement from Mary Oliver. It's called The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down into the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Thank you.